Okay, so what I'll talk about today is constructing the cluster algebra structure on higher Tychmuller spaces for the classical groups. So first I'll explain what higher Tychmuller space is. So what kind of data goes into this? We have to choose some group G. And for us, G will be one of four things, SL n plus 1, SO 2n plus 1, SP 2n, or SO 2n. And these correspond to types AN, BN, CN, and DN. Actually, we want to work with the simply connected versions of these groups. So in the B and D cases, we'll actually be looking at spin 2n plus 1 and spin 2n. But actually, for the purpose of the talk, I'll probably focus mostly on the symplectic group because it's maybe the simplest of the three, well, besides SLN, the three cases. So there are two inputs. There's a group, and there's S, which is a topological surface. Maybe with some kind of data at the boundaries. I should require that it has boundary with boundary with boundary. Most often, we'll ask it to have boundary and maybe some mark points on the boundary, something like that. Okay, so the space I'm interested in, I'll call A, G, comma S, and this is there are a couple ways to describe it. One is the moduli of local systems, of G local systems. On S, with there are a couple ways to phrase this. One is with reduction to U inside G, the maximal unipotent group, reduction to U on the boundary. A more concrete way to think about this is you have your surface. And around each boundary component, we require that the monodromy is unipotent. And also along the boundary, we choose a flat section of the associated flag bundle. So given any G bundle, there's an associated G mod U bundle, an associated flag bundle, and you choose a flat section of that bundle along the boundary. So that's the moduli space we're interested in. It's basically the moduli space of local systems with some small amount of extra data, which is fairly harmless.
Is this complex or real or numerical?
This is an algebraic. Think of G as an algebraic group, okay. So what we can do is take the real points of this space. But actually, you can take it makes sense to take the positive real points of this space. So this is what's sometimes called higher Tychmuller space. Or as also sometimes called the Hitchin component. Let me explain why it's called higher Tychmuller space or the Hitchin component. If you look at let's suppose that S, for simplicity, let's just assume for now that S is closed because the story is simpler here. So if S is closed,
positive real points make sense given what the modus of that.
No, it doesn't yet. I'll explain sort of what it means to take positive real points. But it's something that it's a procedure that you can do in this situation, and taking positive real points gives higher Teichler space. So it's possible to. I'll explain more about how that goes. But so if S is closed, this is just the moduli of local systems. There's no decoration on the boundary, and if you take the real points, this is the character variety for for the real group. Right, and this has components. This has many components, and it turns out one of them is this positive component, and this is the component that's often referred to as higher Teichner space or the Hitching component. Okay. Okay, so.
These are components as, you could say in the classical topology here?
Yeah, in the classical topology. Yeah, so it's a disconnected space. And you know, the different components are distinguished by topological invariance of the representations. Two interesting results. About this space due to Fock and Gontrov. The first one is the statement that the positive points is the Hitching component. And in particular, this gives a parameterization, using various nice functions, which we'll talk about, a parameterization of the Hitching component. The second interesting fact is that all representations of the fundamental group of the surface into our real group are just coming from this component in AGS r greater than 0. All representations here are discrete and faithful. Okay. When S is not. When it's not SL2R? Right. So there's a particular component of the character variety, which has similar extremal properties to Teichmuller space. I'm not sure what kind of question.
Is there any easy way to say what those properties are?
Can you say something about orders?
One thing I can say is that you have representations of pi, the fundamental group, into SL2R, and there's a principal embedding into any other group. Any other split real group. So we use a principal embedding. It's a component that contains this SL2R component. And there are, that's right. It's a component. If you have an SL and Oper, well, it's not. So I think it would be too long to explain it that way. So not going to try. But it's the component that is the deformation space of type Miller space inside the larger character variety. Is that okay? There are other ways to pick it out. It has extremal topological properties. So these are two main results from their paper, and the proofs of these results, come down to giving the positive structure. On AGS. So being able to talk about what kinds of functions are positive. So a positive structure, what do we say? In other words, so a positive structure consists of a bunch of coordinate charts, so a positive atlas. Coordinate charts. So what's a positive atlas? A positive atlas is a bunch of coordinate charts. We require that all transition functions are subtraction free. So proofs of both of these facts come down to, in one way or another, the positive structure, and then there's a little bit of argument, but really this is the main step. Okay, so there are two ways to give a positive structure on this space. So which is to a positive structure. AGS. One that works in the AN case is to write down a cluster algebra structure. I'll later define what a cluster algebra is, but if you have a cluster algebra structure, the cluster coordinates, all the transition functions are subtraction free, so that automatically gives you a positive atlas. The second approach is something that works for other groups. You have to use somehow Lissig's theory of total positivity. Which is fairly involved and ends up relying on quantum groups and other things. But it's somewhat more indirect. My goal then is to be able to extend the first case to other groups. So give a cluster structure on AGS for when G is a classical group. The A, B, C, D cases listed above. So this is the goal, and let me say a little bit about why. So a couple reasons. First of all, it's more economical. In the paper of Falkengontrov, where they do higher type Miller theory, the parts of their paper that deal with Lissig total positivity, I mean, it makes up probably about half the paper. It's quite the arguments are fairly involved and also a little bit indirect. Cluster charts, cluster coordinate charts, are some subset of positive coordinate charts. And you can try to work with a larger set of positive charts, but I mean, arguments become more complicated. Maybe just as an example, already on. So the unipotent group is a as a subset of G, it has a positive structure. But there are many sort of ways to give U a positive structure. One is you can use generalized minors, and this will be sort of closer to what we'll be doing. This is the thing that has to do with the cluster algebra space, which I'll say that has to do with the A space. You can also do it in terms of give positive structures in terms of reduced words. That has something to do with the X space in some sense. But then given any positive structure, there are sort of variations. There are other charts that you can cook up using sort of transposes, what is basically transposes and inverses. And this, I don't know, sort of already if you have two ways of giving positive charts, this multiplies them to maybe eight ways or more. So there are many ways of giving something a positive structure. Let me say, okay, well, let me give another reason. Maybe I'll go all the way over here. So the second reason to find cluster coordinates is that they're more fundamental. The cluster coordinates are the ones that are related to spectral networks, for example. They're the things which are related to snakes. I won't talk about it, but in some sense, there's sort of a theory of snakes as well, also for these other classical groups. If you don't know what snakes are, don't worry about it. And then there are also the functions which are involved in mirror symmetry. Okay. A third reason is that the cluster functions allow an explicit quantization of the space. It actually is, the quantization is of the sort of in some sense dual space, the X space, which I won't talk about so much, but the A and the X are very related, and this is conjecturally related to representations of W algebras. And then the last reason you might be interested in the cluster functions is that there are applications to counting tensor invariance, tensor product invariance. For the group G. Okay. So, yeah.
Good question. So, now you're looking to cluster coordinates for the. Was there, before you find the coordinate, was there any way to know that this space would have had a cluster?
No. I mean, maybe in retrospect, I'll say something. In retrospect, you might realize actually it was kind of there staring us in the face all along, but. I mean, going in, I had no idea. Going in, I just sort of played around with things and thought, well, if there were a cluster structure, it might have to look like this, and tried to figure out what happened. There's no reason to expect that it exists, you might hope it exists for the sake of these applications or some other reason.
So there's no criterion a priori from some initial space to know if to expect.
Not that I know.
Or vice versa. No, no, this surely is not gonna happen.
Yeah, I know. Not that I know. Right. I mean, it seems that anything, any space that's sufficiently Lie theoretic will have a cluster structure. But okay, so that's that. Okay, so the problem. So now I'm going to almost forget about the surface because I'm going to be dealing. So there's some arguments. So if you have a surface, you can take an ideal triangulation of it, and there's a procedure from using the ideal triangulation to basically reduce the problem for a surface to the problem for a disk with marked points. So we'll be considering AGDN, so where the surface is just a disk with n marked points on the boundary. And this space, well, the bundle is trivial, so it's only the flag data. And so this comes down to the space I'll call conf n g mod u. So configuration of endpoints in this flag variety, in this affine flag variety.
So what happens to the bundle on the mark points?
Sorry. So it's on a disk, so it's just trivial all over the disk.
You give me a surface with mark points in the boundary.
So if you have mark points on the boundary, what you do is you have a bundle on the surface. Plus flags along the boundary components. You move the points, and then it's a flat section, or you know, it's a reduction to U along these arcs. And so you can reduce it to this case by sort of cutting and gluing procedures, which I won't talk about very much. Okay, so I mentioned before sort of a priori it may not exist. Let me talk about so what are the problems that we need to solve? So the problems are first of all, does it exist? Second of all, how do you know that you have the right one? The problem of finding and computing with the functions. And then showing that the cluster algebra structure is mapping class group equivariant. And what does this last thing mean? I think probably some people in the audience are familiar with this. There's a cluster chart for each triangulation of the surface, and then you have to know how to go from one triangulation to another. That's the basis. Yeah, exactly. So you need to know how a flip acts, and express that as a sequence of cluster mutations.
Yeah, the problem is that you get class
transformation. Right.
Yeah,
right.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. So yeah. Right. You're only really conf 3 and conf 4 are enough, right? Let me just say that these are these things are handled by looking at kind of in some sense reduced word combinatorics, and this last thing. You handle it by folding and reducing to SLN. Okay. So now I can write down I guess I have to, I'll give a, sure.
Would your definition of AGDN shouldn't be the quotient of this expansion?
Oh yeah. So yeah, so this is G mod U to the N modulo the diagonal action of G. That's what I mean by a configuration space. Yeah, sorry, I should have said that. Yeah, so yeah, what I mean by configuration space of N points in G mod U is G mod U to the N modulo G. Okay, so how do we, okay, so maybe before I give the cluster algebra structure, I have to say a little bit about what a cluster algebra is. So cluster algebra is, and I'll keep this brief because, okay, so what is the cluster algebra? So a cluster algebra is given by a seed. So you start with the seed, and what does this consist of? It consists of an index set I. So I is an index set parameterizing some functions. Index set parameterizing functions. And the functions parameterized by I will give one coordinate chart. There are some frozen variables at it's not really so important for the frozen things. The third thing is a B matrix. So this is So it's a skew symmetrizable matrix. And it's the columns and rows are given by this index set. So given an ordered pair of it in I, you get some number, and that the matrix is skew symmetrizable, and there's some multipliers attached to so d sub I. This is ij, where ij is in I cross I, and di for I and I. So these are just some rational numbers that skew symmetrize the matrix. Does that happen often?
Or? Yeah,
oh, I see. Okay. Maybe I should. And so all this data is maybe best encoded by a quiver, so we can encode with a quiver. Something like this, say if you have two vertices ij, then I have to remember how this goes. I guess bij, let's say bij is I. If you have a quiver with arrows, you can assign a directed quiver, then you can assign the values of the B matrix like this. Then there are, little b are the entries of big, sorry. Ah, sorry, this is bij. For us, what we'll do is we'll have white vertices and black vertices. So, how do you
encode the DIs?
They'll be encoded in black and white. So for white vertices, we're going to let, so for the white vertices, di, d will equal 1/2. And for the black vertices, d will equal 1. And so if you have something like this, I'm going to try to get this right. So let's say this is I and this is J, then your B matrix will look something like 0, 1, negative 2, 0. There's a chance I have the negative signs wrong or something, but the basic idea is that sort of an arrow between a black and a white, in one direction it's 2, and in the other direction it's 1. That is just the convention. But so what is all this? The details of this are not really that important. I won't emphasize this too much. But what it gives you is given a set of functions. So if I have AI for AI. So these are our functions. So this gives us functions in one cluster. How do I move to a different cluster? There's some mutation. Given AI parameterized by I and a particular K in this index set, what we can do is we can replace, we can take the function ak and replace it with a different function, which I'll call mu star ak or something. I'll just call it ak prime. So you can take one of the functions and replace it by a different function. And what's the rule? The rule is that ak times ak prime is equal to the product of over bij greater than, bki greater than 0 of ai to the bki plus the product of ai to the minus bki for ki plus for the negative ones. So you have functions sitting at each vertex, and you multiply the incoming functions and add that to the product of the outgoing functions with some exponent depending on the values of the B matrix. And then under this mutation, the B matrix changes as well. The B matrix changes by some rule. Which I won't go into, but the idea is you have some collection of functions. You take one and you replace it by a different one, and then you maybe take another one and you replace that, and so on and so forth. So what are the functions? Now I'll do an example. So what is the cluster? So I'll give the cluster structure on conf 3, shame on you, for g equals sp8, just to give you an idea how this looks. Okay, so I'll write this down. So you can imagine a triangle, and at the vertices of the triangle, we put a flag. So I'll call it F1 inside G mod U, F2 inside G mod U, and F3 inside G mod U. Oh yeah. So what is a flag for G mod U when G is SP8? What is a flag? So F1, What is it given by? It's given by the following data. It's given by a one form, a two form, a three form, and then a four form. And such that this line is inside this plane, is inside this three dimensional space, inside this four dimensional space. Actually it's given, and then so these, and plus some restriction, so where these spaces, the spaces given by these one, two, three, and four forms, where these spaces are isotropic with respect to the symplectic form. So it's given by a bunch of isotropic subspaces. And from these, so it's an eight-dimensional space. You have a one-dimensional, two, three, and four-dimensional subspaces. These actually determine five, six, seven, and seven-dimensional subspaces because, wedge K is isomorphic to wedge 8 minus K by using the symplectic form. So there's a symplectic form guarantees you. So what we actually have is F1, we can imagine it as being given by U1, U2, U3, up through U7, and we'll do the same for F2, will be V1 through V7, F3 will be W1 through W7. Okay, so those are the flags, and we have to cook up some kinds of functions out of these flags. And of course, U1 through U4 determine U5, U6, U7. But it'll be convenient to use these other vectors as well. Okay. Okay. So it's the cluster algebra, as I said, is encoded by a quiver. And let me write down the quiver. I'll write down the functions at the vertices of the quiver. So let's see how quickly I can do this. Okay, so 6, 2, 3, 4, 4, I'm halfway through, so 1, 6, 1, 5, 2, 3, 1, 7, 4, 4, 1, 6, 2, 5, 3, 4, 4. No. I'll get to that. Sorry. There are a couple more things to write. Okay, and then the white vertices, I'll circle the white vertices. They're basically anything with a 4 in it, I think. No, not those. Okay, never mind. These are the white vertices. So these are white.
In the AN case,
yeah.
All that's black.
All the vertices are black in the AN case.
So white vertices are something you give vertices.
Yes, yeah. So there are white vertices for SP. It has to do with being non-simply laced, the group. So in SP and SO, or spin 2n plus 1, there'll be white and black vertices for spin 2n, it's all black vertices again. Okay, so the circled ones are white, and these are the functions. Let me explain what the functions are. So yeah, I guess I have some room here. So a function which has sort of three. So this is a sort of 3, 6, 4, 3. So that's actually, this is not 36. It's four different numbers. So there are two types of functions. Maybe this one and this one. So let me explain how these are computed. So this function 2, 2, 4. It's not so complicated. It's given by, one way of writing them is using these spin diagrams. And what this means is you take U1 wedge U2 wedge V1 wedge V2 wedge V3 wedge V4 wedge W1 wedge W2. So this is this function. I think it's and then so how about two? I shouldn't have circled this. So I'll explain what this function is. 2, 7, 4, 3 is given by a diagram which looks like 2, 7, 4, 3. So this is slightly not so complicated, but let's see, what do we do? The way I'll write this is you take U1 wedge U2, that's the 2 here. I'll wedge it with this 4 here. So V1 through V4, wedge those together. And then I wedge it with some 2 form. And then here I have U1 through U7, and I wedge it with some 1 form. And what are the 1 and the 2 forms? There's a map here. I have W1 wedge W2 wedge W3. This is an element of wedge 3. And there's a natural map from wedge 3 to wedge 2 tensor wedge 1. And the wedge 2 I plug in here, and the wedge 1 I plug in here. There's a procedure for reading the function off from the diagram. But once you wedge these all together, when you wedge 8 things together, there's a natural volume form, and that gives you a number. And that's what the function is. Is that OK? You look concerned. For the other, yeah. So there are two types of functions. The one, I guess there are these guys too, which only depend on 2 arguments. You're just wedging a bunch of vectors together. For the things with 3 arguments, again, it's just some big wedge power. For these guys, it's some more complicated wedge procedure. Let me say a bit about where this comes from. What was that? Yeah. So it comes from the A diagram by folding. So this thing, it looks like a grid. What does this correspond to? So I'll start on a different board. This is an Zinkin diagram for SP8, and this is in some sense the white vertex, and what is there's the vowel group, so there's an element called W naught inside the vowel group, which is the longest element of the vowel group. And W naught, it turns out there's a simple reflection corresponding to each of these vertices. So let me call them 1, 2, 3. Let's number the vertices 1, 2, 3, 4. And the longest element of the vowel group is S1, S2, S3, S4 to the fourth. And so let me draw a little schematic of that diagram over there. Um, um, So this word, in some sense, like this triangle here corresponds to S4. This parallelogram here corresponds to S3. This parallelogram corresponds to S2. And this one to S1. And then that's just repeated 4 times. So that's how this the cluster algebra structure comes from the reduced word. It's sort of built up out of these little parallelograms and triangles. Okay. We go back. So how would one think of this? So that's a cluster structure. Let me give another viewpoint on it. Another viewpoint is that SP2N embeds inside SL2N. And in fact, SP2N is equal to the fixed points of an involution. And the sigma comes from the Dinkin diagram automorphism, of the A2N minus 1 quiver. Okay. And it turns out that this happens on the level of viral groups as well. So there's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. So the folding of the SL8 Dinkin diagram folds like this. And so the lift of this reduced word is going to be S1, S7. These vertices get identified, S2, S6, S3, S5, and then S4 is just itself. So it turns out that this this reduced word is the reduced word for W naught inside the Va group of SL8. And so what happens is this reduced word corresponds to some cluster structure on SL8. So that for SL8, let's see. I don't know if I'm doing this right, but I think it's probably something like this. There's some cluster structure for SL8 that looks something like this, and what sigma does is it acts on this cluster by sending it to itself, but sort of flipping the diagram, and the quotient of this diagram gives you the SP8 cluster structure. Sorry, which numbers? These functions on SL8, they are pretty much the same functions because a flag is given by a chain of vector spaces with forms also for SL8. And so those formulas continue to hold.
So the fixed points become wide from the other ones.
Sorry?
So functions are
fixed. Exactly, yeah. The fixed ones become white and then the other ones are black, exactly.
Yeah.
I might have, sorry. I. I might not have drawn all the vertices here. But it. Yes, I expect that to be true. Yeah. Yes, yeah. So, right. Yeah, let me rephrase this in a different way, which I think is maybe more palatable. So what happens is sort of so the cluster structure let's just say conf n g mod u for g equals sl 2n. It turns out the cluster algebra this is acted on by the automorphism sigma, and there's no reason a priori for sigma to preserve clusters, and so what the construction of this cluster tells us is that there's what we do is we find a cluster which is fixed. Which is fixed by sigma, which is fixed by sigma. Okay, so that's the thing. And I should say that expressing it in terms of reduced words, you see that you could do this for any reductive group, but sort of the mapping class group in equivariance. That comes down to writing the flip, and the flip is something I can only do for the classical groups. Okay, so how much time do I actually? Maybe.
It's a pretty elastic seminar.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay. Well, maybe I'll go for like a couple more minutes, and then I'll stop, and people can ask questions, and we can keep on. Okay. Okay.
So you cannot do EA exceptional groups.
Sorry. You have a similar picture, yeah.
But you don't know how to prove that the flip works.
Yeah, I don't know. So yeah, so yeah, exactly. So I'll explain I'll explain right here. So what do we need to get mapping class group invariant equivariance? To get mapping class group equivariance, you need two things. You need you'll notice that the diagram is not, this cluster is not symmetric with respect to F1, F2, and F3. It's not symmetric with respect to those. So you need, the cluster we've constructed. Is not S3 symmetric, if those of you who are familiar with the SLN case know that the cluster is S3 symmetric, it's just sort of manifestly S3 symmetric. Here, that's not the case. Some of them are like. I don't know if you can see, like this function, there's an S2 symmetry, which is this function and this function, for example. But some of them remain the same, but then some of them get changed to other things. So what we need need sequences of mutations. That realize symmetries. Yeah, you're right. So to cook up a cluster structure on AGS for G, one of the classical groups, you have to triangulate and also pick an ordering on each triangle, ordering of vertices on each triangle. So you need a sequence of mutations that will realize the various S3 symmetries going from, you could do this construction for any of the other six orderings of the vertices, and you would want to know that it gives you the same cluster algebra, that those clusters are related to each other. So we need some sequence of mutations that realize the S3 symmetries, and then all you need to do is realize the flip.
Is this a sort of mutations? So I guess this mutations implies that this is sort of a Kinshu symplectic morphism,
So if I
code the transformation of coordinates, it's like unjust a manifold. This is
going to
be a K2 Lagrangian.
A K2 Lagrangian?
Yeah.
Wait, so you're encoding the sequence of mutations as a Lagrangian? No.
So the transformation of coordinates can be thought of as Lagrangian manifold.
Okay, yeah.
And I guess it's K2 Lagrangian because the mutation is a K2.
I see, okay.
Is there a condition like K2 Lagrangian? Is it enough to guarantee the result of this mutation?
Maybe written in several inequivalent ways. So yes, if you know it's K2, you can write it as a sequence of mutations, but not
I didn't know that about K2 Lagrangians. Yeah.
The volume of the thing built out of flips may not be apparent. I think this contains more information. It's a particular realization.
Yeah. Okay. So. So, and then the other thing we need is the sequence of mutations realizing a flip. Sorry. Yeah, the two. Yeah.
Are there team variables here or
not? Oh, are they?
Is this already extended by variables used to blue?
Yes. Sorry. I didn't say that. So, right. So, what are the ones that are glue? The ones that only depend on two flags are the ones on the edges. So these guys. This one and these three actually belong on one edge of the triangle, and then these four down here, those are where you glue. Actually, I haven't told you, right? So there's in some sense. In order to glue, what you have to do is imagine this is like half an arrow, and this is half an arrow, and this is half an arrow, and these are half arrows. And this is a half arrow. And then there's this other half arrow that goes like this. So these are the frozen things. And when you put the other triangle on, you either add or cancel the arrows depending on which way they're going. So that's how you glue. I wasn't going to talk about that. Much, but there's a procedure for gluing. Actually, I wasn't going to give. Well, I guess I could give the sequence for the flips. I was going to give the sequence of mutations for the S3 symmetries because it's easy to write down. So this is the same diagram over there. And to realize the S3 symmetries, I only need to mutate stuff in this region. Okay. And so I'll tell you how to realize two of this transpositions that give S3, that generate S3. So I'll just tell you the vertices that you mutate. So I'm going to group the vertices in families. So this will be family 1, family 2, then family 3. And then these other vertices I won't touch. So then what I do is mutate family 1, family 2, family 3, then family 1, family two, and then family one again. And whenever you're mutating within a family of vertices, it doesn't matter which order you mutate them in. Right. So the reason I mentioned, this probably means nothing to you because unless you do the computations, but what I want to point out is that there's some kind of pattern going on that the mutation sequence that realizes one of the transpositions is something like this. There is some kind of it feels like there's some kind of three dimensionality to it if you're familiar with the SLN case. I also want to point out that it's somehow a recursive process. The sequence of mutations is some kind of recursive process. And then the other symmetry is very similar, except for our families. The families you mutate are now 3, 2, and 1. And these don't get touched. I mentioned before that these are taken to each other by one of the S3 symmetries. So these are the only ones that get mutated. And it's the same sequence, 1, then 2, then 3, then 1, then 2, then 1. So I just sort of say this, the details of what the mutation sequences are. If you're interested in the mutation sequences, this is what they are. And if you're not interested, I think the takeaway is that it's some kind of recursive procedure. Hold on, let me think of for a moment. So SO8.
SL8. The cluster, yeah, so the cluster coordinates for
yes.
S2N were obtained from those.
Mm-hmm.
For SL.
Right. Yes, no, that's a good point. So, yes, when I do most of the calculations, I end up doing them in SL8. These are cluster functions in SL8. As well, you have to take the cover and then work on the cover.
So you're somehow saying the entire cluster structure is equivariant under this?
Yes, under this evolution. Yeah, that's what I mean.
So sigma sends flags to dual flags, right?
It does, yes.
So that's why, so the standard for chromatographic coordinates use 3 flags, and so they are not invariant under sigma, because that sends
it yes, to the dual flags, yeah.
Dual flags.
Right.
Like taking a flag, the dual flag, and something strange, something intermediate. Is there a?
These flags are all self-dual and.
No, you're saying. I don't know how to say it properly. I have to understand from the point of view of SLA. What does this cluster call? Is there people will understand this cluster call?
I can draw a little diagram which will a little picture of how I think about it. So here's this the picture of all sort of what are the so this is say the cluster complex for SL8 is this, and then sigma will turn out to take one cluster to a different one, and there's some sort of fixed locus inside of here which are sigma fixed clusters, and this is. Inside of here is the cluster structure for the SP8. So one kind of contains the other. I don't know if that's what you were looking for, or that addresses in any way.
Right, and then the mutations sort of fix
the. Yeah, so the mutations, this sequence of mutations completely lies inside here. You're just going between different clusters inside here.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. I mean, there is a sequence of mutation that say, right, there's a Fokh-Androv and then the dual Fokh-Androv here. And there's some sequence of mutations that takes you in here.
Yes.
And then you know, you're within the SP world. So you might be interested in this. So there's a sequence. Maybe you know this. So there's a sequence that's known to take the Fokh-Androv to the dual Fokh-Androv. And it's in some sense halfway. If you look at the sequence carefully, there many things can be mutated in different orders. But if you rearrange them in the right order, at the halfway point, you'll reach here.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. Sorry, the half the. Uh-huh. I see. Yeah. Right. Maybe I'll end there. There's more that I could say, but I want to let people go if they want to. And I'm happy to answer more questions afterwards. Sorry? Yes. They're yes. Sorry. Yeah. Either they're automatic. Yeah. And I guess I should say one nice thing that comes. So I just talked mostly about SP, but the story is very very parallel for type B SO2N plus one, and you can actually see the Langlands duality between SO2N plus one and SP2N. I mean, these sequences realizing flips and S3 symmetries are exactly the same. Basically, what happens is this diagram is basically the same. The functions change, but the quiver is the same, and then you just flip white and black vertices to get the SON 2N plus one, and that's just a product of Langlands duality. And there are even ways to sort of guess the SO2N plus one, guess the functions. I mean, the quiver is just, you just switch white and black vertices, and then to get the functions, there's a way to guess what the right functions are.
So Schwerin has the model, it's a quiver made out of the thinking diagram. So how does SO2N work?
SO2N?
Yes.
Oh, it's an unfolding of this. You imagine the SL2N was sort of double this, and then you folded them, and then you had some white vertices. And then so now turn those white vertices, switch white and black vertices. So now you're just going to double those vertices that got folded, like the white. So it's basically the same quiver, except these whereas before we were doubling the black vertices, now we'll double these vertices. And then when you double these vertices, you get the SO2N plus two. Another.
Do you expect for the exceptional group to have like many copies of the exceptional thing?
I have no idea. Yeah. It's certainly possible. I guess it's in some sense true for SL2N from that picture. It might be true. I don't know.
Thank you.